Shalom Hadavarnix. Well, I want to welcome you to our next segment, our next session of the First Regathering Modern Israel. We are now on session 39. We're picking it up on page 328 of your notebook, page 328. So as we always do, let's take a quick review of where we've been up to this point. Then we'll start into the new material. Last week, we saw that Operation Protective Edge began in order to stop terrorism. And as part of that operation, the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, blasted their way into Yasser Arafat's Ramallah headquarters and confiscated documents and computers, etc. Those documents clearly linked Yasser Arafat with terrorism. Well, Operation Protective Wall then expanded beyond Ramallah, and soon the IDF forces, beginning in Ramallah, moved into Qalqilya, Nablus, north to Jenin, west to Tulkarm, and south to Bethlehem. All these cities are hotbeds of Islamic fundamentalism. When the IDF went into Jenin in the north, they encountered heavy resistance, and the claim was made that they perpetrated a massacre. Well, even the UN looked into the claims by the Palestinian Authority and came up with the conclusion, and here's a cartoon dramatizing that, Kofi Annan saying, "I'm sorry, there was no massacre in Jenin." Just standard Palestinian exaggeration, hyperbole. But there's Yasser Arafat with blood on his hands and a bomb in his other hand saying, as usual, the UN favors Israel. Well, I wish that was true. I wish the UN did favor Israel, but that's far from the truth. Because of the pressure brought upon Yasser Arafat, he needed to reform his government. Many governments said to him, noticing the corruption and the inefficiency of the government, said, you've got to fix that. Well, yeah, Arafat did shake up his government, but it was less than an earthquake. So this cartoon dramatizes that fact. On the top, we have a cartoon that says, Arafat shakes up government. Well, in the beginning, the government was made up of 32 Arafat clones. When he got done shaking it, it was now made up of 21 Arafat clones. Not exactly an earthquake. At that time, Israel decided to put together a security fence. Here's a photograph of one section of the security fence. This is a photograph of the majority of the security fence, because the majority of the security fence is a chain link fence. Yes, there are access roads and identification roads beside it, and barbed wire, etc., supplementing it. But the actual fence itself is 97% chain link fence with intrusion monitors. However, when you see the fence in the media, you see these high concrete walls. So the impression is left that the Israelis have built a concrete wall around the West Bank, and the Palestinians are now walled into their little ghetto. Well, that is a totally false misconception, because there's a specific reason for the high concrete wall. Now notice the road running along the near side of that wall. Notice that road. Well, the reason for the high concrete barrier is to provide a bullet shadow for the people driving on that road. Here's a diagram of the reason why the concrete barrier is put up and why it's so high. It provides that safety. The snipers cannot touch vehicles driving on the road in the bullet shadow. So that's the reason for the barrier. And notice, at the top of this picture I've written now, the security fence is made up of 3% concrete wall. 3%. Not all of it. A very, very tiny percentage of it. Only in the areas where snipers can be thwarted. And the fence has been very, very successful. This graph dramatizes the success of the security fence. You can see that the number of suicide and bomb attacks from the West Bank in Israel declined dramatically as the fence was completed. All right, that brings us now to page 328 in your in your notebook, and that is the year 2003. We now begin the year 2003. In January, at the end of January in 2003, the elections for the 16th Knesset were held. Then as we move into February, we were faced with a tragedy both in America and in Israel. Ilan Ramon, Israel's first astronaut, was killed in the space shuttle disaster. And of course, it's always blamed on Israel. Now, notice the article that I reproduced there. Shuttle conspiracy theories swamp the internet, from Middle East Ministries. The Haaretz Hebrew Daily reports that anti-Semitic elements have been using the internet to spread rumors that the space shuttle Columbia disaster was caused by a secret Jewish-Israeli conspiracy. Notice that. The space shuttle disaster was caused by the Israelis. According to the smear campaign, Israeli astronaut Ilan Ramon joined the Columbia team as part of a secret attempt to gather intelligence information about Iraq, and the shuttle accident was staged by Israel and America to distract attention from the events in the Middle East. Let's move to page 329. A document released by the Anti-Defamation League states that, quote, Holocaust deniers on the net are making much of the fact that Ramon was the son of a Holocaust survivor and singled out his presence on the mission as evidence of Jewish and Israel complicity in the disaster, suggesting his death was an intentional bid to gain sympathy for the Jewish state. Shuttle conspiracy theories have surfaced in chat rooms, bulletin boards, email messages, and on websites frequented by extremists and anti-Semites, the ADL says. So as usual, everything is Israel's fault or the Jewish fault. Well, let's move on. In 2003, Israel is preparing for a potential attack from Iraq with weapons of mass destruction. Now, the Iraq War was an armed conflict in Iraq that consisted of two phases. The first phase was an invasion of Iraq starting on the 20th of March 2003 by an invasion force led by the United States. During the run-up to the war, President Saddam Hussein threatened to attack Israel if forces invaded his country. Israel responded by preparing the local population for an attack using chemical or biological weapons. See, Israel takes threats like this seriously. And they sent out a call for volunteers, for additional volunteers to help the IDF. And that's the reason. Well, here's astronaut Ilan Ramon. I did have a picture of him. Sorry, I didn't show that earlier. Here's the astronaut Ilan Ramon. Back to where I was. They sent out a call for additional volunteers, and that's why I was in Israel in 2002, at the end of 2002. I was part of this program that was preparing the population for an attack using chemical or biological weapons. At the same time, the U.S. and the Allies are preparing a roadmap for peace. The Roadmap for Peace, or Roadmap for Peace, you'll see it written either way, was a plan to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict proposed by the Quartet on the Middle East. The Quartet on the Middle East is the United States, the European Union, Russia, and the United Nations. The principles of the plan, originally drafted by U.S. Foreign Service Officer Donald Blum, was first outlined by U.S. President George W. Bush in a speech on the 24th of June 2002. In which he called for an independent Palestinian state living side by side with Israel in peace. A draft version of the Bush administration was published as early as the 14th of November 2002. The final text was released the 30th of April 2003. But the process reached a deadlock early in phase one, and the plan was never implemented. Another peace plan that doesn't find fruition. March 10, 2003, Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, is appointed the new Palestinian prime minister. You remember this guy? This is Mahmoud Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen. He's the guy who channeled $70 million in Palestinian funds to European banks through his brother. So now he is the new prime minister. you think there could be corruption in the Palestinian Authority government? I'll leave that up to you to decide. March 19th, the U.S.-led war against Iraq commences. Let's go to page 330, and we'll move into April. April 2003, April 14. Israeli emissaries submit 14 reservations to the proposed roadmap. See, Israel is not particularly thrilled and happy with the roadmap. So they put their input in. April 30th, 2003, the roadmap is officially delivered to Ariel Sharon and Mahmoud Abbas. May 1st, 2003, Allied military operations in Iraq come to an end. May 17th, Ariel Sharon and Mahmoud Abbas hold the first summit meeting. May 19th, 2003, the first Palestinian Islamic Jihad female suicide bomber blows herself up in a shopping mall in Afula, killing three people and injuring dozens of others. So now we have a female suicide bomber from the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And as I've stated before, every man, woman, and child is a potential threat, a potential suicide bomber or warrior. So Israel has to be very, very alert. May 23, 2003. After the White House officials acknowledge Israel's concern about the roadmap in a statement, Ariel Sharon officially accepts it. So he had reservations, but he did say, okay, I'll go with it. Then on May 25, 2003, the Israeli cabinet approved the roadmap. May 26th, Israeli Prime Minister defends the approval of the plan for a Palestinian state. Now, this was raised a lot of criticism in Israel. So this article from the New York Times, in face of withering criticism from his own right-wing party, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon staunchly defended his support for the latest Mideast peace effort today, declaring that ruling 3.5 million Palestinians cannot go on indefinitely. Mr. Sharon and the Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas are expected to meet this week, probably on Wednesday, diplomats said. The two leaders are expected to meet with President Bush for a summit meeting somewhere in the region, probably next week. This would be May or June. Mr. Sharon asserted on Sunday that Israel has no real option but to accept the measures outlined in the peace plan. And notice the next sentence. This is an important sentence to highlight. A mark it up moment. After a stormy session, the cabinet voted 12-7 in favor of it with 4 abstentions. Note, here's the importance. This is the first time that any Israeli government approved the principle of a future Palestinian state. So this is a very, very important precedent that's been set. An Israeli government has approved the principle of a future Palestinian state. All right, page 331. According to a poll published today in Yediot Achronot, a leading daily, 56% of Israelis believe that the country should support the roadmap, compared to 34% who are opposed. So the Israelis want to support peace. However, they are also very realistic. However, when asked if the peace plan would lead to a comprehensive Mideast agreement, 51% thought it would not. Over half thought it would not. Only 43% thought it would. You know, the 51% were right. The realists were right. All right, let's move to June 3rd, 2003. President Bush meets with Arab leaders in Egypt. He says Israel must deal with the settlements and make sure there is a contiguous Palestinian state. Now, the Arab leaders then endorse the roadmap and agree to crack down on terrorism and its sources of funding. Will that happen? Will they crack down on terrorism? June 4th, 2003, President Bush meets in Aqaba, Jordan, with Ariel Sharon, Mahmoud Abbas, and Jordan's King Abdullah. Abbas calls for an end to the Palestinian armed intifada. And Sharon says he understands the Palestinians' need for territorial continuity in the West Bank. Bush names John Wolfe as a new Middle East envoy, charged with monitoring implementation of the roadmap. What happens the next day, June 5th? Hezbollah fires 26 anti-aircraft missiles into northern Israel. Fortunately, there are no casualties. Then on July 20th, Hezbollah snipers fire on an Israeli outpost near Shtula, killing two Israeli soldiers. July 22nd, Hezbollah fires anti-aircraft shells at Israeli jets flying over southern Lebanon. Two Israelis in the nearby town of Shlomi are wounded. So, violence has not stopped. July 29th, Ariel Sharon meets with President Bush in the White House. Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad suspend attacks against Israel for 3 months, while Fatah declares a six-month truce. So it sounds nice. It sounds like we're making progress here. Page 332. August 6th. Israel releases 339 Palestinian prisoners. So at this point, everybody looks like they're being lovey-dovey and implementing the roadmap. August 8th. Hezbollah militants fire rockets and mortars at three Israeli military positions in Sheba Farms. That's a disputed area along the border. Israel retaliates with airstrikes against suspected Hezbollah positions in the disputed area and in Lebanon. So the northern border is still hot. August 10th, Aviv Dadon, 16, of Shlomi, was struck in the chest and killed by shrapnel from an anti-aircraft shell fired by Hezbollah terrorists in Lebanon. Four others were wounded. It's the first killing of an Israeli civilian since Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon 3 years earlier. So the northern border is still very, very hot. September 6, 2003. Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, resigns as the Palestinian prime minister. But don't worry, he'll be back. He's not gone for good. Next day, September 7, 2003, Ahmed Gureya, also known as Abu Allah, is named Palestinian prime minister. And so here's a photograph of Ahmed Gureya. Again, Abu Allah is his Arab name as well. He is now the prime minister of the PA. October 12th. The Geneva Initiative, also known as the Geneva Accord, is a draft permanent status agreement. Okay, it's a potential permanent status agreement, a shot at it. Okay, it's a draft permanent status agreement to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict based on previous official negotiations, international resolutions, the Quartet Roadmap, the Clinton parameters, and the Arab Peace Initiative. You would think that this thing would have it nailed down with all that negotiation in the background and all those factors added in. You would think that this Geneva Initiative, the Geneva Accord, would have the Palestinian-Israeli conflict solved. Well, let me repeat again. If the Palestinians wanted peace, it would have happened long ago. All right, so here we've got this very important document. It was finished on the 12th of October, 2003. The main concepts included in the Geneva Accord include, number one, a mutual Israeli-Palestinian declaration of an end to the conflict and future claims. Two, mutual recognition of both nations and their right as an independent state. Three, almost complete Israeli withdrawal to the 1967 borders with a limited number of settlement blocks on the basis of a one-to-one land swap. Go to page 333. Fourth point, a comprehensive solution to the issue of the Palestinian refugees based on the Clinton parameters of 2000, of which the main component will be compensation and a return to an independent Palestinian state, not a return to Israel. Jewish Jerusalem as Israel's capital and Arab Jerusalem as the Palestinians' capital, with Jewish areas under Israeli sovereignty and Arab areas under Palestinian sovereignty. And finally, number six, a non-militarized, that's very important, a non-militarized Palestinian state and detailed security arrangements. All right, pretty comprehensive document. How will it be received? How will it work out over time? Well, we'll see. We'll see. October 23rd, 2003, a couple of weeks later, The Israeli army has drawn up a plan to implement the cabinet's decision to remove Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, according to a report in the English language daily Jerusalem Post. We have presented plans showing the risks and chances of the operation itself, including the options to remove him alive or not, the paper quoted a senior military source as saying. The government has made a decision to allow the army to act. The army is ready. The army would not comment on that report. Palestinian officials said if Arafat is removed, it would kill the peace process and lead to anarchy in the territories. November 30th, 2003. An article by News from Jerusalem, Israel Today. Four key Palestinian negotiators of a symbolic peace agreement, that's the Geneva Accord, it's symbolic, it's just a draft, have decided not to attend the signing ceremony tomorrow in Switzerland, a blow to the Israeli architects of the deal, led by UltraDove and Oslo architect Yossi Beilon. Their absence clearly undermines the Geneva Accord, which calls for Israel to give up all Judea, Samaria, and Gaza and hand the Temple Mount over to the Palestinians. In exchange, the Palestinians would give up the so-called right of return for millions of refugees and their descendants to their former homes in Israel. But the Geneva Accord has run into strong opposition on the militant Palestinian street, and Yasser Arafat refused to endorse the deal in writing. Notice the Israeli government had endorsed the deal, but Yasser Arafat won't put his signature to a piece of paper. Gunmen even fired shots at the Ramallah home of the chief Palestinian negotiator, Yasser Abdel Rabo, who was also a cabinet minister. Hence, the four Palestinian negotiators dropped out, though they were threatened by their own peace-loving people. So they decided it was safer not to attend the ceremony and be part of it. Well, in December, on December 1st, the Geneva Accords were signed, outlining a draft of permanent status agreements, but the Geneva Accord did not pave a way to a formal peace agreement. One more attempt that went down the tube. All right, page 334, we come to December, December 18th, as we near the end of 2003. December 18th, Sharon announces his intent of unilateral disengagement. We are going to disengage from the Palestinians. We don't care what they do, independent. We are going to be independent of them and just get out of their territory. All right, that brings us to 2004. We start on January 5th. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon addresses the Central Committee of the Likud Party and affirms his disengagement plan for unilateral withdrawal. We're just getting out. We're just getting out of the Gaza Strip, period. We don't care about what the Palestinians do or don't do. He announced it, of course, in December 2003 at the Herzliya Conference. Sharon informs the committee that as Prime Minister of Israel and head of the Likud Party, he plans on going forth with his plan if the Central Committee refuses to go along with him. So the Likud Party is a very conservative party, and he's saying, guys, we're on our way. Follow or get left behind. That's basically his statement to the Central Committee. I'm doing this. January 30th, Israel exchanges over 400 prisoners and the remains of close to 60 Lebanese with Hezbollah for a captured soldier and the remains of three other soldiers. Notice 400 prisoners for one living soldier and three corpses. See, Israel values their soldiers. Israeli values each other. Each Israeli values each other. We as Jews may argue a lot, but the Israelis definitely value one another. We'll see this kind of pattern repeated over and over again. Let's move into February. February 3rd, February 13th, 2004. The White House declares that unilateral disengagement from Gaza may help ease tensions between the two parties, but that the final settlement must be reached through negotiations. So it all looks positive at this point, doesn't it? Israel is exchanging prisoners. Israel is saying, we're giving you territory back, we're getting out. Everybody thinks it might be hunky-dory. However, a big change comes on March 22nd when the IDF kills Hamas founder Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Israel assassinated the spiritual leader of the Islamic terrorist group Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, as he emerged from a mosque this morning in Gaza City. That's March 22nd. And again, here's another picture of Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. He's the spiritual leader of Hamas. He is one of the co-founders of Hamas. Let's dig into this assassination a little bit more. First of all, how was it accomplished? Israeli helicopters fired three missiles at the wheelchair-bound Yassin, killing him, his son, and several bodyguards. What was the result? The attack sent some 200,000 Palestinians into the streets for the funeral, and they chanted slogans calling for revenge. Words cannot describe the emotion of anger and hate inside our hearts, said Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh. The killing of Yassin was condemned across the world, in the Arab states, in Europe, and by the UN. America had a different tune. America, which had been leading the war on terror, did not criticize Israel. Let's remember that Hamas is a terrorist organization and that Sheikh Yassin was himself personally, we believe, been involved in terrorist planning, said National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. And now we begin to find out why the assassination was carried out. Page 335. Since the beginning of the Oslo War in September of 2000, Hamas has perpetrated 425 terrorist attacks of various types, killing a total of 277 Israelis and wounding 2,076 civilians and soldiers. Don't forget those who are wounded, you guys. They're often maimed. They often carry the wounds for the rest of their life. They're just as important as those killed. 277 killed, 2,076 wounded by Hamas. The decision to kill Yassin at the earliest possible opportunity was made 6 days ago, 2 days after a double Hamas attack in the Ashdod port that killed 10 Israelis. The terrorism has really been curbed by the PA, hasn't it? Yasser Arafat has really done a great job of living up to the Geneva Accord and to any kind of statement he made to stop terrorism. He wasn't willing to accept the Geneva Accord or any other previous accord. Just lip service from Arafat. At a meeting of top Israeli defense and political leaders, it was decided to embark on a full-scale campaign to wipe out terrorism in Gaza, with both religious and political leaders in the crosshairs. So basically, the Sharon government said, enough is enough. Let's do what the Palestinian Authority is not doing. But 10 years later now, this is 2015, 10 years later, terrorism still thrives. All right, March 24, 2004. Abd al-Aziz Rantisi chosen as the new leader of Hamas. And here's a picture of a poster of Abd al-Aziz Rantisi. He was one of the six founders of Hamas in September of 1987, along with Ahmed Yassin. So he's a co-founder of the Hamas group. March 25th, the U.S. vetoes a Security Council resolution condemning Israel for killing Ahmed Yassin. April 14th, President Bush commends Israeli Prime Minister Sharon's withdrawal plan and recognizes that territorial modifications will be made to include large settlement blocks. April 17th. Israeli security forces kill Abd al-Aziz Rantisi, co-founder of Hamas and successor of Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Why did they assassinate him? Rantisi took part in establishing the terrorist policy of the organization and also served as its main spokesman. He played a key and active role in inciting to carry out terror attacks. April 18th, page 336, April 18th. Israeli Army Radio reports that the following the assassination of Abdelaziz Rantisi, Mahmoud Zahar becomes the leader of Hamas. Hamas did not publicly announce Rantisi's successor out of fear that Israel would target him. Makes sense. All right, I see we're now at our break. So let's go ahead and take our break. You go, guys, take your 15 minutes, and we'll pick it up in about 15 minutes after the break. All righty, let's get back at our class. We are now at April 19, 2004. We're at the top of page 336 in your notebook. All right, April 19, 2004. Israel gives the U.S. a written commitment to dismantle illegal settlements. So Israel's moving ahead with the attempts for peace, putting down on paper what they intend to do. May 19th, 2004, Marwan Barghouti, convicted of murder for his involvement in three terrorist attacks in Israel that killed five people. He's convicted of murder for those five attacks. Remember, Marwan Barghouti is the Tanzim leader. He's the leader of the youth militia side of the Palestinian Authority. He was acquitted for 33 other murders due to lack of evidence of his direct involvement in those particular crimes. So he's put in jail. He's still around, though. June 6, 2004. Israel's cabinet approves a compromise disengagement plan whereby Israel would evacuate all 21 settlements in the Gaza Strip and four settlements in the northern West Bank. Now we come to June 14th, 2004. I ran across this article that shows you the negative view of Israel held by most of the world. And of course, that's fully in line with the idea that one day Jerusalem will become a cup of trembling for all peoples. And it's continuing. The movement in that direction is continuing. So here is an article by David Margoli in the Jerusalem Report. June 14, 2004, and I've taken some excerpts out of it. Listen to what he says. Listen to what he says. Increasingly, decent people on the left seem either to disdain Israel or to view its disappearance as a necessary step toward a peaceful world. What an analysis. Got to get rid of Israel. This international plague, the increasingly unthinking assumption that Israel is at best all wrong, has infected even the nominally Zionist Jewish left. Pundits provide the reasons for this. Ignorance of the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Israel's association with colonialist America. Prime Minister's connection with the Sabra and Shatila massacres, and now the evil Bush. He's associated with those evils. Israel's defective public relations and Palestinian success in portraying themselves as the victims. And a well-oiled Arab anti-Israel propaganda campaign, to name a few of the reasons. And David writes, all true. But somehow, none of that fully explains why thoughtful friends in San Francisco have become partisans of the Palestinian cause, let alone why Portuguese Nobel Prize novelist José Saramago compared Israel's treatment of the Palestinians to Auschwitz. Man, that is far out, isn't it? Not even close to what the Germans were doing. An anti-fascist Greek composer, Miki Theodorakis, called Jews the root of evil. Decent folks, all of them. And I mean it, says David Margoli. My friends are cultured and tolerant people with whom I share a wide range of political and lifestyle opinions. Yet they seem unmoved that part of the Palestinian design remains the destruction of Israel. So I fish for explanations where politics mixes with the metaphysical. So now he's getting into, he doesn't want to say it, but religion. He asks the question, does the Jews' near miraculous national birth and homecoming insult the left's religion of universalism by suggesting once again the Jews' uniqueness? Well, you know, folks, he's right. The Jews are a unique people. Amos 3:2. Amos says, you only have I chosen from among all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for your iniquities. So we are the chosen people. The Jewish people are the chosen people. And that is a double blessing. You know, God made all the peoples of the world, but he chose Israel to be his specific people for a specific mission. And that's a double blessing, to be the chosen people. He goes on. Or is the left's rancor merely an expression of the antagonism toward Jews that seems built into the world's foundation, as if God himself put it there? That's why I brought up Isaiah 40, verse 2. Notice what God says through Isaiah. Speak kindly to Jerusalem. Call out to her that her warfare has ended, that her iniquity has been removed, that she has received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. You know, there's a principle in Scripture of double blessing. You know, the Jewish people have received double blessing. First of all, they're a people, then they're the chosen people. But the principle in Scripture goes on to indicate that double blessing means double responsibility, to be righteous and to walk in the paths of the Lord. So double blessing brings double responsibility, and when we fail that, it brings double punishment. Double punishment. So David Margolis is sensing some correct biblical principles that the Jewish people are unique, and God himself has built into the foundation of the world that if we are disobedient, we will receive double punishment. He goes on to finish up his article. My friends are not anti-Semites, to be sure, but I wonder if they might be like canaries in the mine, unaware as they fall before the daily vapors. And beyond both politics and metaphysics, how shall I cope personally as my good friends become my enemies? Well, he's groping with this. He's trying to cope with it, as he says. None of it makes sense to him. Why should these people hate Israel so much? Why should his good friends, who share so much in common with him on the left, become his enemies because he's pro-Israeli? Well, you see, remember, this doesn't make sense until you understand the metaphysical reason, the spiritual reason, the biblical reason. And that understanding is an understanding of the satanic cause behind all this hatred. You know, Israel as a chosen people has a covenant relationship with God. And that covenant relationship puts double responsibility on us. But Satan is at war with God, and he knows that if he can destroy the Abrahamic covenant, that's our universal and that's our unconditional and eternal covenant with God, the Abrahamic covenant, unconditional and eternal. He knows that if he can prevent that covenant from being fulfilled, then God is not strong. God can't keep his promises. And he knows that his career of rebellion is safe. So Satan tries to destroy the three promises of the Abrahamic covenant. It's three legs, you know, spiritual blessing, land blessing, nation blessing. He tried to break the spiritual blessing promise by trying to destroy the mission of the Messiah. And he actually supported the mission of the Messiah unwittingly. And so that leg of the Abrahamic covenant is solid and strong, the spiritual blessing leg is solid and strong. So that leaves the nation promise and the nation promise and the kingdom promise. Or I should say the land promise and the nation promise. Excuse me. The land promise and the nation promise. Now, the nation promise depends on people. So if he can destroy the Jewish people, he's destroyed that leg of the Abrahamic covenant. And of course, the land covenant means that Israel should be in possession of a certain territory. So if he can destroy that leg of the Abrahamic covenant, the covenant is destroyed. So that's why he constantly goes after the Jewish people. See, that's why the Holocaust was an attempt to destroy the Jewish people worldwide. Believe me, it was worldwide. It would have gone worldwide if the Nazis had won. That was an attempt to destroy the nation. But now we have the modern state of Israel. So all of these attempts to destroy Israel are an attempt to destroy the land promise, of the Abrahamic covenant. But of course, all this will work out according to God's plan. This will all work out according to God's plan. But remember, anti-Semitism and the fact that the whole world will soon become anti-Israeli doesn't make sense until you understand the satanic cause, the satanic foundation behind all this hatred. He must destroy the Abrahamic covenant. If he does, it cannot be fulfilled, and his career is safe. All right, let's move on. June 18, 2004. The Second Intifada is over and Israel has won, is the opinion of columnist Charles Krauthammer. After four years, 1,000 deaths and thousands of others maimed, wounded. Remember, thousands maimed and wounded. Thousands, 1,000 deaths and thousands injured. June 30th, the Israeli High Court upholds Israel's right to build a security fence, but it makes slight modifications on the route. So notice that the government did not have a free hand in putting up the security fence. The security fence had to be vetted. It was challenged in court. And it had to be examined and analyzed. And it was approved. However, that's not the opinion of the world. July 9, 2004, the International Court of Justice issues a non-binding advisory opinion that Israel's security barrier violates international law. In other words, to them, you can't protect itself. It's wrong. It's illegal to protect yourself from terrorists. Israel is outraged by the ruling, saying the World Court ignored the issue of Palestinian suicide bombers. Israel said the barrier will remain in place to keep bombers out of the country. How did the Palestinians react? Well, the Palestinians, of course, welcomed the decision as historic. This is an excellent decision, says Yasser Arafat. Why? Because it supports terrorism by opening the door to the terrorists very, very wide. Page 338. In February, Israel felt that approximately 30 countries, including the European Union and the United States, felt that The Hague did not have the authority to rule on the legality of its security barrier. So that's why this International Court of Justice issues a non-binding advisory opinion. Well, they never had the authority to rule on any opinion on the security barrier to begin with. Israel's case for the barrier is simple. It's necessary to keep suicide bombers out of the country. And again, this is a markup moment. Mark up the next statements. An absolute halt in terrorist activities has been noticed in the West Bank areas where the fence has been constructed. Infiltrations into Israeli territory had emanated from areas where the fence had not yet been completed. Israeli cities that had been a target have been quiet. Not quite, that's a typo there. Israeli cities that have been a target have been quiet since the fence has been erected. So those two statements tell you that the fence speaks for itself. October 13th, 2004, the Sanhedrin reconvened. A unique ceremony, probably only the second of its kind in the past 1,600 years, is taking place in Tiberias today, October 13th. The launching of a Sanhedrin, the highest Jewish legal tribunal in the land of Israel. The Sanhedrin, a religious assembly that convened in one of the Holy Temple chambers in Jerusalem, comprised 71 sages and existed during the Tanaitic period. That includes the first century, and several decades before the Common Era until roughly 425 CE. Details of today's ceremony are still sketchy, but the organizers announced their intention to convene 71 rabbis who have received special rabbinic ordination as specified by Maimonides. That's Rabbi Maimonides, an ancient rabbi, very influential. October 25th, 2004. Doctors arrive to treat Arafat. Israel has given permission to a team of doctors from Tunisia to fly to Ramallah to treat Yasser Arafat, who has been suffering from gallstones, an intestinal infection, high fever, and vomiting. The doctors entered the Mukata compound on Saturday night, where Arafat has been confined for over 2.5 years. Arafat's health has recently been on the decline, and Egyptian doctors have reportedly already been at Arafat's side since last week. Although his aides deny he is seriously ill, the emergency call indicates that he is suffering from more than a common flu. And according to some reports, Arafat, who suffers from Parkinson's disease, may have to fly abroad for surgery. October 27th. Ariel Sharon's pullout plan wins resounding victory in the Knesset. The Knesset votes 67-45 with 7 abstentions to approve the plan. So the Israeli government was behind these attempts to separate the Palestinians from the Israelis and bring some sort of a peace. Page 339, November 11th, Arafat dies. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's health continued to deteriorate. On October 28th, Egyptian, Tunisian, and Jordanian doctors were treating him. He was falling in and out of consciousness. On October 29th, he was flown from Jordan to Paris, France, for emergency medical treatment. Senior Palestinian officials began to plan for a change in leadership. On November 11th, 2004, Yasser Arafat slipped into his final coma and died in Paris. The cause of death was undetermined. And by the way, it remains undetermined up to the present, even though it's been looked at very closely by medical personnel. Mahmoud Abbas is elected to succeed Arafat as chairman of the PLO. So now we have Mahmoud Abbas in the saddle again. He's buried. Yasser Arafat is buried in Ramallah, November 12, 2004. Guess what? Who's to blame? That last sentence there, you guys. Palestinian terror groups accused Israel of poisoning Arafat and vow revenge. And that's in spite of the fact that his cause of death has never been disclosed up to the present. All right, that brings us to 2005. January 9th. 2005, Palestinian Authority election, Mahmoud Abbas chosen as president. So he is now formally elected to the highest position in the Palestinian Authority. He remains president up to this day. January 24, 2005, the first ever commemoration of the Holocaust by the UN. The UN was formed in 1945. This is January 24th, 2005. 60 years of indifference by the UN. The UN wasn't all that happy to bring Israel into the family of nations, but they did, and they showed their indifference here by this 60-year gap in recognizing the Holocaust. February 8th, 2005. Summit at Sharm el-Sheikh, attended by Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, and Jordan's King Abdullah, during which Sharon and Abbas declare an end to the violence. Jordan proposes deploying Palestinian soldiers on the northern part of the West Bank. Israel approves the offer, although the plan is never put into effect. Jordan also deploys ambassadors to Israel. February 9, 2005, the reestablished Sanhedrin convenes to discuss the Temple Mount. Let's go to page 340. February 16th, 2005. The Knesset approves the disengagement implementation law to compensate Jews who will be evacuated as a result of the disengagement plan. March 16th, 2005. Israel transfers control of Jericho to the Palestinians. So you see this, a unilateral withdrawal is underway. March 17th. Multiple Palestinian groups agree to informal truce until the end of the year. March 20th. It is reported that Israel's defense minister approved the building of 3,500 new housing units between Ma'ale Adumim settlement and East Jerusalem in the E1 corridor. And the disengagement continues. March 21, 2005. Israel transfers the control of Tul Karim to the PA. May 26th. In a meeting with Abbas, Bush declares that changes to the 1949 armistice line must be mutually agreed upon. Abbas claims that the PA is willing to work with Israel to help plan the disengagement from Gaza. June 29th, 2005. More than 20 mortars are fired across the border. By the way, this is the northern border again. Corporal Uzi Peretz of the Golani Brigade is killed and four soldiers wounded, including the unit's doctor. Fire was exchanged, and helicopters and planes attacked five Hezbollah outposts in the Reaches Ramin area. So Hezbollah in the north definitely doesn't want any peace agreement. July 12, 2005. The PA has not curbed terrorism because a Palestinian Islamic Jihad suicide bombing kills five in Netanya. Israel responds by re-entering Tul Karim, and Hamas increases rocket attacks in the south. Yes, terrorism has really been curbed, hasn't it? All right, August 15, 2005, we move to page 341. Israeli soldiers begin to give notices to settlers in Gaza that they must evacuate their homes within 48 hours or they will be forcibly removed. Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz announces that Israel intends to hold on to the main settlement block in the West Bank and the Jordan Valley. So they're not going to disengage from there. August 17, 2005, the forcible evacuation of Jews in Gaza begins. All right, you have this map on page 341, and it's a map of the Gaza Strip. It's a part of the Palestinian plain, or I should say the Philistine plain. Small portion of the Philistine plain. And the major Israeli outposts, the Gush Katif area in the south of the Gaza Strip, then Kfar Darom in the center, Netzarim in the north center, and then in the north, Nisanit. These are the primary areas to be in which settlers are going to be evacuated, whether they like it or not, against their will or voluntarily, depends on them. Well, most of the settlers were not interested in being evacuated from the Gaza Strip. And here's a picture of the forced evacuation of Kfar Darom. You see the settlers on top of the building there. They've set up barbed wire. They are resisting the police and army as they are advancing to remove them from their homes. Definitely was not a good time. It was a heartrending time, both for the Israelis who were removed from their home and for the Israelis who were charged with the removal. And this is a heartrending photograph of exactly that happening. Here, a brother Israeli is embracing a brother Israeli as they remove him from his home. And there you see another brother Israeli in agony over this forced evacuation of Jews from their homes. Jews removing Jews from their homes. Very, very traumatic time for Israel as this disengagement commenced. All right, we're now on page 342. August 22nd, 2005, disengagement from the Gaza Strip is completed. August 23, 2005, disengagement from four settlements in northern Samaria completed. August 29th, Sharon declares there will be no more disengagements. The future territorial concessions will be handled in accordance with the roadmap, and reiterated that large settlement blocks will remain in Israel. September 20th, the last army units leave settlements of Ganim and Kadim in northern Samaria. All right. Well, that brings me to an article that I wrote and published in the Hadabar Messianic Ministries newsletter. And let me tell you why I wrote the article. Read with me that top paragraph. Recently, from 1991 to the present, the United States and Israeli governments have been accused of ungodly decision-making from those who espouse fervent religious Zionist and Christian Zionist theology. The two governments are criticized for the philosophy of giving up land for peace. The latest accusations stem from the recent Hurricane Katrina natural disaster and the turnover of the Gaza Strip settlements to the Palestinian Authority in August and September 2005. However, these accusations are unwarranted because they ignore pertinent biblical and historical facts. Now, let me make it perfectly clear. I'm not a big fan of the unilateral disengagement from the territories that have been promised to the Jewish people. I'm not a big fan of that. If you asked me, should we disengage from the territories? I would probably say no. But you know, folks, God's not asking me. God's not asking me. And we must remember, first of all, that God is sovereign. And he put Ariel Sharon in place. He raises up governments. He brings down governments. He put Ariel Sharon in place, knowing exactly what Ariel Sharon would do. So you can't say that God is being caught by surprise by the unilateral disengagement. So we have to take a look at the Bible when we evaluate all that's happening and not throw around all kinds of accusations regarding the events that happened in the Middle East. But we must temper those, our views of what's happening in the Middle East, with the biblical data. And so that's just what I'm asking for here. I'm asking for believers to look at some biblical data that has been ignored in the disengagement process and view the disengagement process through that grid. So that's what I'm doing in the article. And so we're going to move through that article next week, not in detail, just going through the major points, explaining why I think we need to be careful against accusing governments and individuals of ungodly behavior. Just right off the bat, we need to take a comprehensive view of the data and evaluate it from that stance. Okay, so next week we will take a look at the points that I've written up in this article in the Gaza Handover. So come on back next week and we'll pick it up there on page 342. So we'll see you then.